Worldwide, an estimated 4% of children have food allergies, and other adverse food reactions like intolerances and sensitivities are even more common. What are the known risk factors for pediatric food allergies and intolerances? What are the concerning health consequences if these conditions are not addressed? And how can the functional medicine approach help?
Kids need so many calories to grow and so many carbohydrates to grow that if there's going to be more than one food coming out, I always make sure that they're in with a good nutritionist so we can make sure that their diet is high quality. Especially in teenagers, sometimes food restriction can actually be a trigger for an eating disorder. And so I'm very careful, especially in kids that have lost a lot of weight quickly. I really try not to restrict their diet. I really try to figure out other ways to get at the problem. And maybe it's just improving your diet quality.
On this episode of Pathways to Wellbeing, we welcome Dr. Rebecca Carey, a pediatric gastroenterologist who is also certified in functional medicine as well as clinical nutrition. Today, we're talking about food reactions from a pediatric perspective and how these issues experienced in childhood may impact not only pediatric health, but also influence the health and wellness of our patients later in life. Welcome to the show, Dr. Carey.
Thanks, Kalia. It's great to be with you to talk about pediatrics and food, two of my favorite topics.
I bet. And these are important things to talk about. But when we go and we Google it and we want to do our research, it can be really confusing because of all the terminology that's used, right? So yeah. I thought I'd start there today and talk about food allergies versus intolerance versus sensitivity. Will you just help us get grounded in this concept, get on the same page, and tell us kind of the general definitions and differences between these conditions?
So that I think this is probably one of the most common things we talk about in the office because it is so confusing to families. Yeah. So let's start with food allergies because that's probably the one thing that most people can understand the easiest. So those are typically IgE mediated. Usually those symptoms are fairly acute. So patients will have difficulty breathing, hives, rashes, maybe lip swelling. They're the ones that are going to most likely cause anaphylaxis. And the ones that if you do go to the allergist, you're going to be most likely to have positive skin prick testing, need to have an epinephrine pen. Now, there are two non-IgE-mediated food allergies in pediatric patients, which I think is probably very interesting and not well known by the wider community. So they're typical in infants, and one is called food protein-induced enterocolitis syndrome, and the other one is called if you want to talk about complicated names, food protein proctocolitis. So that's typically a baby that's having bloody stools, or the other syndrome is usually a baby that's having a lot of vomiting. So there are a few non-IgE-mediated problems in babies, but across the lifespan, the IgE ones are going to be more acute. And you can go to the allergist to sort of sort that through. Now, food intolerances, that is a huge category of food reactions. So that can be a reaction to something in the food like a dye, a chemical, a reaction to caffeine. It could also be a problem with sugar digestion. So lactose intolerance is a very common food intolerance. Or there's one that we see a lot in pediatrics actually called sucrose isomaltase deficiency. And that's, believe it or not, that's an inability to digest sugar, like table sugar. And that can cause a lot of symptoms for children. And then the last big category where probably most people think end up being in is like the food sensitivity category. So these are patients that are having some type of immune reaction to the food, and they can have GI symptoms and non-GI symptoms. And I'm sure we'll get into all the different details of that later in the talk. The difficulty with that is that we don't have as well validated testing, I think, in pediatrics as we do for the other two types of food reactions. So,
well, thank you for giving us some clarity. I just knew you probably get this question in the office all the time and from colleagues. The mom part of my brain knows that other moms are listening and they want to know, are these things I'm going to notice when I have an infant, or is it appearing, you know, in early childhood? When do I start to see the signs that my kiddo is not doing well with a food?
So that actually, you can see it any time across the lifespan. And so the reactions are very age dependent. So a baby may have severe vomiting or poor weight gain or blood in the stool, whereas older children may develop food aversions and just have abdominal pain or diarrhea. Or the teenager, especially if they have something like eosinophilic esophagitis, may have difficulty sleeping. And then sometimes the families are going to see non-GI symptoms too. So definitely there are things like hyperactivity, brain fog, rashes, moodiness, those type of things that families start to often question, you know, is this food related? So there's no one real answer to that, but really, you know, a lot of foods can cause a lot of different symptoms, and they do change over the lifespan.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like just being diligent and kind of monitoring, is my child acting normally, responding normally, and raising the red flag when anything abnormal happens. But are there, we always talk about, you know, pattern recognition in functional medicine. Are there any signs that we can look for from someone's environment or their family history or other immune conditions that they have that might tell us about their general risk for developing some type of food reaction?
So that's a great question. And you can actually, sometimes when we take the history in clinic, just by taking the history, I almost feel like I know what the child is going to have. Yeah. So celiac disease, I think, is a very obvious example. So if there's a first degree relative with celiac disease, so if your mom or dad has celiac disease, then you have about a 30% chance of also having celiac disease. Other things that are non-celiacs, so more like protein intolerances, food sensitivities, infants who are reacting, if a mom had a C-section, or if the mom didn't breastfeed, antibiotics have been shown over and over again to be like triggers for children later on developing food allergies because of the effects they cause to the microbiome. I think there's a little bit of data on pollution. Depending on your background, your race, whether you're African American or Caucasian or Hispanic, you're going to have a more likelihood to have maybe lactose intolerance or specific types of food allergies. So yeah, there's actually a lot in the history that can kind of point you towards thinking of food as a trigger for the patient's symptoms.
I can see now how using a functional medicine model with our timeline and our focus on the antecedents, triggers, and mediators could really help you collect a lot of information about what might be contributing to this patient's symptoms. Yeah.
Yeah. And then actually sometimes patients, as we go through the evaluation and the workup and we come to the final diagnosis and then we go back and look as a group and we are all able to sort of identify that trigger, whether it was an infection or the antibiotics from the ear and, you know, from the recurrent ear infections, or then just the family's genetic history. It can be very cathartic for the families. Like they're like almost relieved. So as a parent, we have an abnormal amount of guilt. We like whenever our child is sick, we somehow like blame ourselves and maybe we're not nurturing them properly or giving them the right food or giving them the right behavioral structure. And so when families are able to kind of realize what the triggers were, and maybe they were triggers that are out of their control, it actually takes a lot of that pressure off the family, a lot of the guilt that, you know, they're here to make their child better, but they're not the cause. It's a very irrational guilt, but it's as a parent, it's really hard to sometimes get it out of your head that it's not your fault that your child is sick.
Yeah. Yeah. Deeply felt as a parent. It's kind of along the same line. I think when we're making decisions about our children, it can be so intimidating. And something I wanted to bring up with you today is food introduction and how that might contribute to things like allergies or even just sensitivities. Will you give us kind of your go-to conversation that you have with patients who are wondering, like, did I do something wrong with food introduction? What's best practice? What should I do with a new baby if my other children have allergies?
So the if a there's a lot in that question. So if an older child has like a milk allergy as a baby, we yeah. actually usually recommend that if the family has another baby, if the mom is breastfeeding, they avoid dairy. And if the child's going to go on a formula, they do a dairy-free formula. That's kind of unique for milk. But in terms of other food allergies and food allergy prevention, the data is very strong right now that you should introduce the most diverse food really as early as the child is developmentally ready. So whether that's 5 months or 6 months, depending on the child's oral motor development, that you should be introducing those foods. I think the most important thing for families to understand is those foods that you introduce have to be real food, like whole foods, and that you want to introduce fruits and vegetables. Really, I try to get people to do vegetables first and make sure they get all of those bitter, not very tasty vegetables in, because then the fruits are usually much more widely acceptable, and then they can progress to like nut butters and peanuts and, you know, if the family eats meat, they can progress to meat and egg and things like that. So really the data really is very strongly towards trying not to delay food introduction, because it's basically shown that it doesn't prevent allergies and that the earlier that you introduce foods, the better. Encouraging breastfeeding is another really important thing. So we know that breastfed babies will tend to have less allergies over their lifetime. So encouraging families to really try to get through that 12-month time point to continue to breastfeed is also really important. And then we talk a lot in the family about processed food. And that one of the things that we see a lot in the pediatric patient is a condition called ARFID. I don't know if that's a condition you've heard of before, but avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. And actually, in the most recent, it's really classified as a disordered eating disorder right now. And I used to think about it just in young children, but really we're seeing adolescents with it. And so once the kids really get a taste of the processed food, sometimes they're so resistant to going back to whole foods and to fruits and vegetables. So we really encourage families to delay introduction of a lot of the processed foods, and definitely, you know, water, pushing the water obviously is really important, avoiding all of those sugary beverages, because once the kids start to get a taste of that, it can be really difficult to get them back in. And the willpower of some of the children, you know, when they're resistant to eating healthy food is pretty dramatic. And it's not just willpower, it's also they have a lot of sensory issues. And so it can really lead to malnutrition and poor weight gain and failure to thrive if you don't try to set the family up correctly.
Yeah, it makes great sense. And I like that we're thinking about bringing in all these flavors. I was joking with someone recently that Brussels sprouts have really had a PR comeback. They're on every menu, and before we used to think of them as not being very appetizing. So that was just a really comforting answer, I think, to both practitioners and just parents who are trying to make these decisions, really comforting. Will you talk to us about some of the most common allergens that you see in the pediatric population? Is this the same for adults? Are there some food allergies that we're seeing more and more in children?
In children. So we definitely in the baby, dairy and soy are probably the number one food allergens or food reactions we see in the infants. And as they get older, it becomes more like the adult population, where you start to see gluten and wheat playing a bigger role. And then I would say egg. Egg is quite common because there's a lot of cross-reactivity with dairy, with egg. And then we don't see too many nut allergies in our clinic, because those are generally managed by the allergist. And so those are probably the most common ones we see. And, you know, I've been doing pediatric GI for 20 years, but I've been doing pediatric GI for 20 years, and it really has risen dramatically. And not just single allergies, you know, kids with multiple different food reactions, food allergies, and then the nutritional consequences of them, obviously, you know, are pretty profound too.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that there can be a pretty wide spectrum of symptoms that we might see. And I think many of us are prepared to look for immediate GI symptoms, or if someone has a swollen tongue and it's hard for them to breathe, I think we're all prepared to look for that. But I imagine that especially in the pediatric population, there are some more nuanced or subtle symptoms that we might miss if we don't know what we're looking for. Will you tell us some of those common or maybe not so common signs and symptoms that we should be looking for?
So definitely growth is probably one of the most important non-GI symptoms that we follow in the pediatric population. If you take your child to the pediatrician's office, everybody has a growth chart. We use Epic, and it's nice because the growth percentiles are in a color. And so we always like show the families a chart and say, like, you just need to be on, you need to pick a color and you need to stay on the color. So once kids start to drop off the growth chart, whether it's their height velocity or the weight gain, even if they don't have any GI symptoms, that clearly needs to be evaluated. Delayed puberty is also another one. So if we have boys, usually it's more boys, but if their boys are having problems going into puberty, then we always worry about like a nutritional deficiency or a food related issue. And then there can be outside of those things, which are kind of growth and nutrition, definitely, eosinophilic esophagitis and leg pain. I mean, who would have ever thought that those two go together? But that is not uncommon. Obviously, rashes, a lot of headaches. People get a lot of headaches when they're having problems with food. Their energy can be impacted. And some families notice differences in like their attention too when the food, when they've identified certain food triggers. Acne, I would say, can sometimes be like a symptom of you're having an issue with a food. So does that, hopefully that answers your question.
Really helpful. And you were right. I mean, it seems like multiple body systems are involved and we're really looking at a wide variety. And I understand that there are reactions that will happen immediately and reactions that might be more delayed, which presents a certain set of challenges when you're trying to make this diagnosis. What does that look like in the real world? What's the time frame in which we could observe a reaction to a food?
I would say, obviously the IgE related foods, that's going to be within hours. But and usually the intolerances are fairly quick too, within a couple of hours. Like if you have lactose intolerance, usually you have a problem within a couple of hours. Or if you're having a reaction to a dye or histamine, it's usually within a couple of hours. But the food sensitivities, it can be hours to days. And I feel like their symptoms are more kind of just up and down. And so families just aren't usually able to figure it out without either doing testing or an elimination diet, because they don't jump out at you as much. They're not so, oh, I had that food and then something terrible happened. It's just that I just don't feel good every day and I know something is wrong and I need help kind of figuring it out.
We talk about that when we teach about the elimination diet here, right? That you have to wait sometimes that full 72 hours after introducing a food because maybe you're going to get a headache or a migraine or have something pop up a little while
and
later.
I love the IFM symptom tracker. Like I think it's a really nice tool to help families when they're putting food back in.
Yeah, to help look for some of those subtleties. Now, let's say we don't catch something because it was difficult for us to identify. We didn't know what we were looking for. What are some of the potential health consequences for a pediatric patient if we just don't catch these food reactions in time?
So the probably celiac disease has the most profound long-term complications. It's actually not uncommon for us to diagnose a pediatric patient and then realize that the parent already also has it. And then the parent has probably had it for years. And then you look at the family history and they've had a history of infertility, or they have a history of osteopenia, or something like that. So celiac disease, those obviously have pretty profound implications. Some of the other ones, we know for sure that if celiac disease is missed, that you have a long-term increased risk of other autoimmune diseases. We definitely know that failure to thrive, lots of nutrient deficiencies. We see lots of nutrient deficiencies in the pediatric population, iron deficiency, but also B12, not uncommon. So I think those can be negative long-term impacts. Growth, if kids are developing feeding issues and restrictive eating around food, if they don't have enough calories to grow, then they're not going to gain weight and grow. And if you think about it, most 2 to 3 year olds have to eat like 2 to 3 times what we would have to eat per body weight for them to grow. So, you know, they miss 100 to 200 calories a day and, you know, suddenly they're not growing. And then that impacts their school attention, that impacts their susceptibility to infection, impacts their brain development. So there can be a lot of long-term implications if we don't identify the right disease. We need to make sure we give them the right diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've mentioned both cognitive function and the health of our mood. And that makes me think of the gut-brain axis, and it's something that we talk about so often. Is that something you see frequently in your practice with children who have food allergies or food reactions that maybe haven't been addressed right away? Do you see changes to behavior or to their mood or to sleep that then improve after you remove those foods?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt. When, especially the younger kids, when they don't feel well, they don't act well. You know, they don't sleep well. They don't listen well. They don't sit still in class well. So the younger kids, it is usually more kind of acting out. And then I think the older kids, I don't see as huge a link in my patient population with, I would say, depression, but anxiety, there's a very big connection, because to the teenagers in particular, they become fearful of eating. And so they worry that, you know, when they do eat and they're out with friends, that they're going to have to go to the bathroom, or they're not going to be able to attend an event or get through soccer practice. So they develop a lot of anticipatory anxiety around food and just around just eating out in general, or eating at home in general. And so that can be a really big struggle. And then we talk a lot in the clinic about disorders of the brain-gut interaction. And we just try to get families to really understand that you're not just a heart. You're not just, and this is like why I love functional medicine, because it's really given me the tools to really explain this to family. Like, you're not just a intestine or a stomach or a heart or a brain, that you're like this unbelievably complicated individual with different genetics and different environment, and you have different things that make you happy, and you have different things that you need to do to stay healthy. And so getting families to understand that there's not usually one thing that they have to do to be healthy, but they have to look at every aspect of their life when they're not well. And so whether that's sleep or their stress or their food or their friend choice, or teenagers, there's a lot of vaping in the teenage population. So, you know, is that contributing to, or are they overusing technology? So kind of the brain-gut connection, the conversation around that, it opens up so many doors for us to be able to talk to the family, and to, because our goal is always self-empowerment, right? So we love taking care of people and getting them better. But at the end of the day, we want people to leave our clinic. We want them to be able to be discharged and to have all the tools that they need in their tool belt, so they can pick the right foods for them and they can have a diverse diet, and they know the things they need to do for sleep and the amount of exercise they need to do and the positive relationships that they have in their family and the supplements they need to take. But kind of they can take it with them, and that they don't need to come back every 6 months for us to remind them what they need to do to stay well. Mm-hmm. So that's why I love talking about the brain-gut connection, because it opens up so many doors.
Well, something that's really struck me in every question that we've talked about today, you've talked about working with families. This seems like a very collaborative, I mean, clearly with a pediatric patient, you need to have a relationship with the caretakers also. What does that look like? What is this therapeutic partnership between families or caretakers, or kind of the systems network of this patient? What does that look like in your practice?
So we, I mean, families are usually coming to us looking for a diagnosis, right? So they want to know why their child has abdominal pain or vomiting. Or so once we can give them a clear diagnosis, then I always talk to them about how do you guys as a team want to go about treating this disorder or this diagnosis. And so sometimes, you know, patients do need antibiotics or sometimes, but sometimes you can treat them with herbal therapy. And sometimes you need to treat constipation, but sometimes you can improve that with diet quality. So I usually try to go through the different options for families. I mean, sometimes you do need to be on a dairy-free diet and sometimes you do need to be on a gluten-free diet. So there are things that I'm like adamant about, like these are the things we have to do. And then I try to kind of layer on top of that. But these are the things that like we can work together as a team and kind of keep moving them towards, you know, them kind of owning it. And so I really try to stay away from the come into the office, the doctor tells you what to do, here's the pill, take it, come back and see me in 6 months. And actually, I think that's, we have had a really busy practice and we see patients, you know, from 2 to 3 hours away. And I think that's probably one of the reasons, because families feel like they're listened to when they come here. They feel like we're interested in their past history. We're interested in how they want to treat the condition. And we always try to come back to kind of wellness and, you know, the functional medicine matrix is like kind of the basis of how we want to move forward. And I don't use this funny because I don't use a lot of functional medicine words when I talk to families, because I don't think they really understand them, but they know the difference between wellness and not wellness. And they know the difference between a prescription and a nutritional therapy. So we kind of, you know, we try to talk to them in their language. So, and I think I wouldn't do anything different. I mean, it can be really rewarding, you know, to see kids come in sick and not growing and then going off to college. I mean, it's really exciting.
Beautifully said. And I can only imagine the necessity of creating a container that feels really safe and nourishing for families that might be facing some stressful decisions. I'm just imagining maybe having one child that has some reactions to foods, and now all of a sudden you have to change the menu and your grocery shopping and the lifestyle for the whole family. Does that type of conversation come up often in your practice?
Oh, I mean, a lot. It's you know, peanut allergies and different types of allergies are so common. So sometimes these poor families, they've got one child with an anaphylactic peanut allergy and then a baby with a milk allergy. And then maybe the 10-year-old's got celiac disease. And so can you imagine trying to navigate that. And so we like to partner with our psychologists a lot, because they can really help families develop coping skills and coping mechanisms, help them see the silver lining in the struggles they're going through. And then I've worked with both nutritionists and dietitians, registered dietitians over the years, and having one of them involved is super important, because we really can't give them all the support they need. And so relying on those other healthcare professionals is really important.
That collaborative care team feels invaluable in this situation.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. Like they say, what do they say? It takes a village.
That's right. That is exactly right. And thinking along those lines of so many different interventions we could choose from, and maybe doing several interventions simultaneously, we touched a little bit on a short-term diagnostic elimination diet earlier. And the elimination diet, I only work with adults, but this is beloved to me. I sometimes wonder how I would do this with kids in a pediatric population. So will you tell us, is this appropriate? Is this an appropriate intervention for the pediatric patients?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt. I mean, for our babies, fortunately, you only need to, if you're worried about a milk allergy, you really often only need to take dairy out for like 7 to 10 days. Because usually if the baby's having bleeding or severe vomiting, the symptoms actually get better fairly quickly. In the older patient population, when you're trying to see, is the elimination diet going to help their irritable bowel syndrome, or do we need to do the elimination diet because their SIBO has been particularly difficult to treat, then I like the 3-week IFM elimination diet. For kids who have like eosinophilic esophagitis, or we're doing like a specialized therapeutic diet plan, like the specific carbohydrate diet, which is a type of elimination diet, they have to be on the diet for months before you see an impact. And I usually try to do, other than the rare situation, like the other day I saw a little guy with just severe eczema, atopic dermatitis. He was miserable. It just wasn't sleeping at night. And the family had done a pretty strict, like 3-4 food elimination diet last summer and had had good work. And mom wanted to do, some food sensitivity testing. And I really encouraged them to do the 6-food elimination diet and to do it properly, you know, to take everything out for 3-4 weeks and then to slowly put them back in so they could really identify the triggers. Cause I didn't want them to, because sometimes the food sensitivity testing can be helpful, cannot be helpful. It's kind of sometimes a little bit of a hit and miss in the little guys. And so that patient, I would have them work really closely with the dietitian to make sure that he's getting really a really nutritious diet on top when they are doing the 6-food elimination diet. Now, the single food elimination, whether we're taking dairy out or just taking gluten out or maybe dairy and eggs out, those I feel like the families can get a good idea in 3 weeks whether it's helping or not. And most of those, there's a lot of, as long as we educate them about the substitutes for those type of foods, I don't always have them see a dietitian. But definitely if I take more than one food out, we always get them with a dietitian. We've seen a lot of patients over the years that the family have either kind of started restricting the food, like they take dairy out, it gets a little bit better, then they take gluten out, and then the child starts losing weight. So there's a lot of, kids need so many calories to grow and so many carbohydrates to grow that if it's going to be more than one food coming out, I always make sure that they're in with a good nutritionist so we can make sure that their diet is high quality. And we do use a variety of different supplements too. There's some really nice supplements, whether the child has a feeding tube or doesn't have a feeding tube, that we can use to supplement their diet, that they're, they tend to be dairy-free, gluten-free, you know, free of most common allergens. So we definitely use it. It really is the gold standard. It can make a huge difference in how kids feel, how kids grow, how kids act. But I'm just a little bit careful with taking too many foods out at one time. I think the other thing that can sometimes happen is that, especially in teenagers, sometimes food restriction can actually be a trigger for an eating disorder. And so like I'm very careful, especially in, kids that have lost a lot of weight quickly. I really try not to restrict their diet. I really try to figure out other ways to get at the problem. And maybe it's just improving your diet quality, you know, let's really rethink where we're eating and how we're cooking. But I don't want to trigger something else that's going to then complicate its issues down the road. So I don't know, it's not a really clear answer, but I think every patient that comes into the clinic is a little bit different. And so we really try to tailor, you know, what disease do they have? What's the best medical advice for that patient? And then try to keep their diets as diverse as possible, because it can have like negative impacts on their growth and their mental health too. I mean, try being a 16-year-old that can't go to the pizza store. You know, I mean, I've had celiac patients that were so sick at diagnosis, and then they come back 5 years and they, you know, they've kind of lapsed on the diet because of the peer pressure. And so trying to, you know, support people emotionally through that, I think is also really important, because none of us are perfect, right?
That's absolutely right. And yeah. I really appreciate this individualized approach. I was just thinking in my mind as you were talking about all the kids who play sports every night and how it must be so important to meet their caloric needs, make sure that they have the energy that they need while they're removing food groups to power their athletic activities if they're involved.
Yeah, that's really important. That's another group of kids. I usually try to have them see the dietitian and try to find a supplement or at least a super high power packed smoothie that they can take to keep up with their activities.
So we the elimination diet is an option, but when mm-hmm. she's on specifically to celiac testing, when is that appropriate for kids?
Yeah, so this is like, this is such a passion of mine because I totally believe in universal screening. And so fortunately, like Italy has just adopted universal screening for celiac disease in 2023. It passed the legislature. And there's a really nice study out of the University of Colorado where they looked about, I think they looked at 3,000 kids and they started doing, 10,000 kids actually between the ages of 1 and 7. And they did TTG IgA screening, which is kind of the best laboratory test for celiac disease. And there was about a 2.4% prevalence, which is probably higher than what we think, right? We've always sort of say 1%. And so I hope that will eventually be something we see in America. I don't know if it will, but I think every patient that walks into your office should have a celiac test. And so there's two main reasons, because it's one of the few diseases that we have a really good test. I mean, it is 95%, about 95% specificity and sensitivity. It's a really good test. There's a very low chance of celiac disease if it's negative. And then if it is positive, you can get the person to the appropriate, person for diagnosis, and you can then you can anticipate their long-term complications, right? So it really helps with planning for the future. And the other thing is, if you have celiac disease and you go on a gluten-free diet, it can sometimes be really challenging to then get gluten back in to get the diagnosis. So say you're really, really sick with, and you have celiac disease and you go gluten-free and you feel great. And then you come to my office and you say, I think I have celiac disease. Can I get tested? And I was like, well, do you want to put gluten back in? Many times people are going to say, no way am I putting gluten back in. And then the testing can become a little bit unreliable. And the current recommendations are to put gluten back in for 12 weeks before you start testing again. So it's a really long 3 months if you ever want to put gluten back in. So I feel like people should like come into my office and fill out the health questionnaire and I can give them the celiac lab test and they go on their way. So we just order a lot of it. And I think it's just one of those things that you should do. Should be one of the first things that you think about, because celiac disease is the great masquerader, right? I mean, you can have no symptoms. You can have terrible symptoms. You can have GI symptoms. You can have neurological symptoms. So I feel pretty passionate about that. You can probably tell I feel pretty passionate about that one. So anyone who walks in your office, celiac testing.
Wow. This is fascinating to me. I love this part of the conversation because right now I feel like there's a lot of resistance to do celiac screening. I mean, I have patients who are quite symptomatic and they'll go to their primary care doc and say, will you screen me? And it's hard. It's hard to get the testing. So I'm so interested to see what happens as we watch other countries initiate some of this screening. And maybe, like you said, the prevalence might be quite a bit higher than we initially imagined.
And you know, if you diagnose a child with celiac disease and they do not yet have another autoimmune disorder, you're going to protect them for the rest of their life from other autoimmune disorders, because you're going to heal their intestine, right? And so it's one of those things that I talk to families a lot about. I think the other thing that happens too is sometimes regular pediatricians or family practice doctors just kind of recommend gluten-free diets, but they haven't completed the testing. And then people come and see us and we want them to put gluten back in, and it can be a really challenging conversation. So it's really, most insurances cover that test, and it can be done at any lab. It's not a specialized lab. It's around. You can go to ARUP, you can go to LabCorp, you can pretty much go anywhere for that test. And so it's just the total IgA and the TTG IgA, and pretty much over 2 years of age, it's a pretty reliable test.
Okay, this was my biggest clinical takeaway from this episode, but I want to know what you think our listeners should take away. Is there anything that is just really pressing to you that you want functional medicine practitioners or parents who are listening to take away from this episode?
I mean, I think the celiac testing obviously is really important, but I think the other thing is I always encourage, sometimes parents go to their physician and don't always get the answer that they want. So I encourage parents to not give up, you know, and, you know, continue to seek those providers where they're going to get their, the answers from. And, you know, there's no bad question. And then on the practitioner side, I really encourage people to test. Like, don't be afraid of testing in pediatric patients. You know, there are a lot of regular tests that can be done through routine labs that can give you a lot of answers. And so whether that's celiac testing or alpha-gal testing or IgE food allergy testing or stool studies, there's a lot of stool studies that look at pancreatic function and fecal calprotectin, and there's a nutrient levels. I mean, that can take you a long way to making a child's life better. So don't be afraid of getting labs on the children and actually getting them tested. Obviously, there's a wide range of other tests that can be done within the functional medicine space too, but there's a lot that can just be done at a regular lab too. So just encouraging practitioners to not be afraid of testing their pediatric patients.
Yeah, that's a really important note and another one well received on my end. Dr. Carey, it's just been a pleasure chatting with you today. We can sense your passion for this topic, and we so appreciate all the clinical insights you've shared with us. Thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks. It was great to be with you.
See you next time, everyone.
To join the conversation on this topic, visit IFM's pages on Facebook and Instagram. For more information about functional medicine, visit ifm.org. The future is functional.